My name is Sue, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Basically, when I came into AA, or came back to AA, I was basically on my way to my own funeral. And by the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm here today. God willing, and if I don't screw this stuff up in the next couple weeks, on February 1st, I will have 5 years. My sobriety date is February 1st, 2005. I have a home group. It's a Vision for You in Charlottesville, Virginia. We meet twice a week. Wednesdays, the Salvation Army is an open big book study. And Saturdays, over Hinton Avenue United Methodist Church, 12 and 12, 12 steps, 12 traditions. And so if you're hanging around town either day, we welcome you warmly. And come down and see us. We'd love to have you. I guess where it all started, what makes me different from the folks out there? You know, we wouldn't be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if, you know, when we take a drink, something happens to us. You know, I heard something this morning, I have a busted thinker, I have a busted drinker. I'm definitely one of those folks. When I put alcohol or another substance in my body, I have a different reaction than the folks out there. And over almost 20-some-odd years, I went back to prove again and again I cannot drink or drug like other people. And I'm going to respect the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I want to share my own experience, strength, and hope. And this story may include a little bit of drug usage too. But a primary, you know, I definitely have a desire to stop drinking. My very first drink of alcohol, and actually I'll go back a little ways, about a little family history here. My mother during Prohibition used to run alcohol from Canada to Idaho. That was my grandma. And my dad is an alcoholic, active alcoholic. I have a cousin somewhere, hopefully she's still alive, who's a heroin addict. So there may be some genetics. But I can't blame my genes, I can't blame my parents, I can't blame the dog. I am an alcoholic. From a very early age, I started sharing beers with my dad. You know, whether it be at a picnic, or whether it be in a home setting, you know, he would have his beer set out, good old Budweiser, and you know, I don't know if any of your dads shared beer with you early on. Yeah, okay, I see one out back there. And sure enough, Dad, here, have a little bit of the beer. Just a little bit. You know, let's let little Susie have a little bit of the beer. And even from the early ages, like 6, 5, it did something different to me. That it didn't ignite anything in my brother and my sister. I'm the youngest of three, grew up in Northern Virginia. But it did something different in me. I liked it. And if I had a sore throat or if I had a cold, Mom would make a hot toddy. You know, have a little bit of Jack, you know, in it, and a little bit of tea, a little bit of honey, a little bit of lemon. And boy, did I have a lot of sore throats going on. I loved a good hot toddy. Mom, my throat is hurting me. You know, and not going for something that, you know, salt, hot salt water, you know, to gargle with. I like the hot toddies. And that was different again from my brother and my sister and my mom. But I was very similar with my dad. There was always alcohol in my household, whether it be beer, whiskey, wine, whatever. And there was a lot of things that went on in my early childhood, including a little bit of physical abuse. My dad, you know, as Ashley mentions in her big book, you know, talk about the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde effect. Boy, it was there with him, as it is with me. Including, you know, some, you know, there was a lot of fist flying back then. You know, I won't go into those details, but a little bit of that happened in our household. You know, it wasn't the average, I guess maybe the average alcoholic family, And that was just my experience. But the really, if you want to call it the really first drink that I the one drink that really changed everything was I was about 12 years old. A lot of us, you may have the same experience as I did, started drinking about that age. Really started drinking. And for most 12-year-olds, drinking does not mean conviviality, but for me it did. Summertime, parents are away, best friend Beth is next door, and a liquor cabinet, not locked up. And we proceeded to mix, rum and coke together, good old Bacardi. And it started off with, a little bit of rum, a lot of coke. And then it proceeded to drink a lot more rum. And we hid this fact from our parents. We actually poured brown colored food coloring, and we tried to put some water in because we didn't want our dad to find out. But I found out later that Dad did find out, because it didn't quite, taste the same. And we proceeded at 12 years old to get totally bombed. That was just my experience, and I can't blame my friend Beth. She didn't pour the liquor down my throat. But when I took that drink, boy, did I feel different. I felt good. I never felt that I fit in before I drank. Started that drinking. I always felt like the square peg in a round hole. I didn't match up with other folks. All of a sudden, this tall, geeky, pimple-faced girl was Suzanne Summers. Kelly LeBrock. It was like, damn, this is doing something to me. I felt sexy. I felt good about myself. I felt like I felt a part of for the very first time. So alcohol really started kicking in at that young age, age 12. And, I kind of lucked out in a lot of ways because I'm kind of tall. And even at that age, I was really tall. On the weekends, we would go to college kegers. Grew up in Northern Virginia, and there's a lot of colleges up there, George Mason, American University, UW, Georgetown. And at that young age, 12, 13, I would hang out with the college kids and drink. And it wasn't just a, hey, let's have a little good time. It was just one purpose only, to get totally drunk and to pass out. And to the point where, I would be kind of walked home or driven home, or I don't know how I got home, but to the point where I'd sneak in and pass out in my own bed. And during the weeks, it really didn't affect my school. But even my grades started getting affected at that point. Another part of my history, I've had a lot of medical problems even from an early age, born with an immune disorder. And for those of us with some medical issues, we know drinking and drugging is not conducive to good health. And my health really started deteriorating, and health problems really started kicking in with infections, and I ended up having to go on homebound education and back up and down the road to Johns Hopkins, having surgeries and being hospitalized. And with those surgeries, I was introduced to prescription narcotics. And it was just amazing. This little white pill or red pill or some other pill, it was like alcohol, and it had the same similar type of effect alcohol and did on me. And where an adult maybe was given so much it would knock them flat out, it took 2-3 times as much to knock me out. And I remember this one surgery, the anesthesiologist was like, "This is kind of weird. This is not normal." And, it was pretty scary times there. For the doctors, they kept on saying, "I think we have a problem here." They'd talk to my mom. They'd be like, "I think she has a problem." No. And she was one of my biggest enablers. And it just deteriorated. I mean, the amount that I was drinking when I would be out with friends, or the amount that I mixed up, and it was a sheer miracle that, you know, I didn't die at that young age. By my senior year, I actually got physically better. And I was able to actually go to school and, you know, be in the school with my friends. And my first, I guess if you want to, I guess for lack of better words, was physical problem that I had, overdosing and also just alcohol poisoning, was actually in my high school, one of my classes, where I actually had some heart problems and actually killed over, and they had to call the ambulance and taken to Fair Oaks Hospital, and I was put into an ICU. So again, people are saying, I think she has a problem. And they addressed me. I think you have a problem. No, it's okay, I can stop. I can do this. I won't drink anymore. I won't do this anymore. I can stop. I can do it. I can do it. I can do it. Did I stop? No. By the miracle of miracles, I graduated high school, and actually with a really good GPA. I have no idea how that happened. None. And I had a lot of friends that were involved in the fire department. Fire and rescue. And, you know, there was one group of people that never seemed to get in trouble, ever, you know, with their drinking or drugging, and a lot of my good friends did that. And they were the ones that were cops, firefighters, or paramedics. And so, even though I really like helping people, I had some interest in the healthcare profession, I was like, oh, that sounds kind of full. Plus, I'm a little bit of an adrenaline junkie. And so I became an EMT and then progressed to a paramedic, went to George Washington University. Again, I don't know how I went through this program, but I did. And I graduated with really good grades. Again, have no clue. But I'm also a perfectionist. And as I mentioned, actually, an opportunity to speak recently is still... As much as we've worked on getting rid of our shame, guilt, remorse about what we've done, it's important for me to say this. As a healthcare professional, a paramedic, so when you call 911, you're getting me. I was under the influence some of the times, most of the times, while I responded. You know, I'd get off work and I would be totally, you know what, I would be out. But during the times, either I was going through a hangover or going through shakes, you know, I was not the person you would really, when you called 911, you wouldn't want me to respond. But I, again, excelled at the job, and, you know, everybody thought, wow, you know, Sue is awesome. But a lot of my close friends, including my boyfriend, was getting a little bit concerned about me. You know, here's this big, burly man. 250, 6'2", and I was drinking him under the tables when we would go in out. And these are cops, firefighters, paramedics, and we had other healthcare professionals, including nurses, who can drink pretty good, I might add. A lot of the paramedics, we were cross-trained as far as in RNs, too. I mean, it was just amazing. And I would be drinking these people out under the table. You know, a 150-pound woman would be doing this. And in 1992, you know, again, drinking and drugging is not conducive to good health. I had a grand mal seizure in my mom's kitchen. I was visiting my mom, summertime, it was grand time, and I just bottomed out. And for a woman, she actually told me this afterwards, she actually peed her pants. She said, Sue, you had a grand mal seizure and you almost broke your neck falling over, and it lasted several minutes. And, of course, the call goes out, and everybody hears the call. They know where I live. You know, seizures. And they're like, Sue doesn't have epilepsy. And several people came to the hospital, and including my boyfriend. And the truth was finally found out. I couldn't hide it anymore. It was there. I accepted some help at that point, kind of beaten to that state of submission, as we get to. And went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was in the cafeteria at Fair Oaks Hospital. And I will never, ever forget this meeting, the very first meeting. And my conception of Alcoholics Anonymous was a bunch of old guys, trench coats, you know, and this meeting was a bunch of guys, actually, but none of them had trench coats on, just average Joes like you guys. But there was one woman in this meeting, just one woman, and she saw me coming in and pointed at me and went like this and patted on the chair. You know, I have no clue what the topic was of that meeting. Absolutely none. I have no idea what they were talking about. I just knew they were talking about the things that were going on, like, within me. How do these people know that? You know, I cannot stop drinking. I cannot stop this stuff. And I got all these things going on in my mind. And they're staying sober? How the heck are they doing that? I started IOPT. I was discharged from the hospital, intensive outpatient treatment, went to the classes, was told to go to meetings, had this little paper sign, and I was the type of person, I don't know if there's anybody here tonight, but I was one of the type of people that would sit in the back row, just go to the meeting, and then run up, get my paper sign, out the door. I did not get a sponsor. Home group, I have no clue what a home group was. The steps, I knew they were on the walls, and by most of the times, you know, I looked at them and I said, I got it, done. Okay, I can do the steps. I never saw one of these things. You know, I never even dare opened up one of these things, the big book. I stayed sober for the wrong reasons. For my boyfriend. I stayed sober for my parents. I stayed sober for my job. But I didn't stay sober for myself. I was not drinking and I was not changing. And within a year, because I was not drinking, I was in sobriety, for lack of better words, I went back out, first opportunity, and boy, was I gone. And my health deteriorated even worse. I stopped with the career as a paramedic. I was able to get a job. And at this time, I actually had moved from Northern Virginia up to Winchester, Virginia. And in the Commonwealth of Virginia, it happens to be illegal to go doc-to-doc to get prescription narcotics. And I had another one of those interventions, kind of like what I had back in 92, but this time it was by a Virginia State Trooper knocking at my door. It wasn't a warm, fuzzy invitation. It was, you know, you're under arrest. I was charged with 2 felonies. Again, these are one of these things that still gets me. It's a miracle. Again, there's proof in the pudding that there's something out there looking out for me. It was knocked down to 10 misdemeanors. I did serve a little time up in the Winchester Frederick County Jail. I was on probation, had to go to ASAP. And one of the funniest things, because I started going back to meetings, I actually got some help up at Edge Hill Recovery Retreat Center, which is run by Alcoholics and Addicts. We're Alcoholics and Addicts. And really, man, you go to 3 meetings a day, they use this big book. And it was like bam, 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 24/7. And I remember meeting one of these women, these AA women, in a meeting. I had no idea who she was. And after my court hearings and everything else, you know, I got my probation officer's card. And one of the guys in the meeting was knocking me, saying, you know who that is? I'm like, oh, no, that's her. And actually, that was one of the women that I asked to be my sponsor. So my sponsor was my probation officer. And she had it's interesting taking a pee test from your sponsor. There's no lying there. And especially, I haven't seen you in a meeting lately. It was an incredible experience. Started working the steps, opened up Big Book a little bit. Was of service. I had a home group. I was actually a treasurer. It was a smoking meeting. I cleaned out those dirty ashtrays, and I don't smoke. Started a little bit of coffee making, even though I wasn't even a coffee drinker at that time. It was just an incredible experience, and I started getting around the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, started, you know, going to, you know, or the district meetings out in Winchester. It was like, wow, this is awesome. Got a job back and started rebuilding my life. But I didn't proceed in the steps. I went up 1, 2, 3, 12. You know, there's something that happens. You know, step 12 says, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, meaning 1 through 11, and I definitely did not have a spiritual awakening. And within about like 4 years, I stopped going to meetings, stopped talking to a sponsor of mine, stopped participating in my home group, and sure enough, you know, things were being progressed. I was working myself towards a relapse. And first opportunity, I was mentioned to my friends who gave me a ride up here tonight. You know, it was hard to go to the grocery store and see one of you guys. It was like, oh my God. You know, they haven't seen me in a meeting. Oh, geez. But I'm okay. I'm fine. Everything's okay. But first opportunity to move out of town to a place that doesn't know me. I got a job up in Hagerstown, Maryland. Even they have an awesome program up there. And, you know, I chose not to participate in it. And within a year of moving to Hagerstown, within a year, I went back out yet again. Again, not drinking, not changing, bound to repeat the same thing. So, boom, off and flying. And from 2000 to 2002, it was pretty bad. It was wicked bad. Health, horrific problems. Tried to go into rehab a few times. You know, I can tell you, I mean, up and down the East Coast, I've been to probably, I can't even tell you how many detoxes and rehabs I've been to. But again, not returning to you guys, the program of action of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a stretch of period of time in 2002 that I stopped. It was about 6 months. My mom was diagnosed with cancer. And I stopped drinking for that purpose. And helped her. You know, and she was going through that disease process. And on January 31st, 2003, she passed away. 2 days later, first opportunity, I was at a memorial service. After everybody left, we, you know, putting on a good atmosphere for everybody, family broke out in an argument, and there was a big old box of box wine. And I took the biggest glass, probably about the size of this sucker, I think actually a little bigger, and filled that sucker with the wine and chugged it down within seconds. And that instant relief was there again, you know, without having the solution inside. So there it was 2 days after my mom passed away, drunk as a skunk. And I basically was that for the next several years. My health, my God, it really deteriorated at this point. Where I went from that 150 pounds to 215 pounds, my liver failing, horrific health infections. Most of the surgeries that I had back when I was a kid was on my face, my eyes, and my sinuses. And, I mean, they were just, oh my God, things were just happening really bad for me. I couldn't work. My friends that I had gone, it just destruction. You know, I call the disease of alcoholism as almost like a cancer. It's a terminal disease unless you treat it daily, have that remission. It's like this fatal disease. I mean, it is a terminal disease. It's progressive. And it was just killing me. It was killing me. Like my mom's cancer. And I ended up actually moving to Stewart's Draft, Virginia, from Winchester. My dad decided to move down there. Here I am with my alcoholic father. And imagine a 70-year-old alcoholic taking care of his 30-something-year-old alcoholic daughter. And that's basically what my life became. And I was living in my bedroom. The only purpose I got was to get up and go out and get the alcohol. My dad had a good supply, or to get the prescription narcotics in and out of hospitals. That was my existence. And in 2005, January, things, you know, reached that point where it was just really falling apart. And my last drink was January 31st, 2005. And I had just one last more escapade in me. And I had some connections still up in Hagerstown. And I got in a car, raced up to Hagerstown, Maryland. I actually got pulled over by a state trooper. But I was actually going through massive withdrawal. And by the miracle, I did not get a DUI or anything else. I said, "Officer, I'm sorry. I will slow it down." Gave me a speeding ticket. Off I go. Get to Hagerstown, and this guy won't give me anything. So, oh, man. Going through horrific withdrawals. I actually had a puke basket in my car. It was just so bad. And left in frustration, you know, I actually went to a grocery store. My last drink was a Suter Home Little Bottles. That was my last drink of alcohol. 4-pack of those. Sick of the dog. That was it. You know, February 1st is when I actually went to my primary care physician, and he intervened. He said, and I actually had a really bad infection at that time. He said, "We need to admit you to be treated with this infection. But you've got another problem here." We've got another problem. And something within me said, okay, that gift of inspiration is there. I'm dying physically, mentally, spiritually. And I accepted. I was admitted to Augusta Medical Center. I had to be put in an isolation room. If y'all have been visiting somebody in a hospital, there's yellow gowns and masked up, and that's where I was. And I was withdrawing off of the alcohol, off of massive doses of methadone, massive doses of Dilaudid. God knows what else was in my system that I can't even remember to this day. And because of my health status, they had a cold turkey in me. Hooked up the IVs, and actually, because I couldn't get a line, they had an IV in my neck. And just my liver was failing, my kidneys, everything was just failing. Spent 7 days there. But during that time period, I had a gentleman come and visit me. And he was a counselor. Guy came in all gowned up. And he also mentioned to me that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He wasn't just a counselor, that he too is one of us. And he shared his story with me. You know, I'm just shaking. I'm praying to God and the porcelain goddess both ways. Just going through horrific withdrawals. And here's this man just telling me his story. And something was breaking through to me. But the one thing that really got me was he took out of his pocket this prayer book that he had with him 15 years before when he was in prison. Somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous gave him that prayer book 15 years ago, and it helped him. He says, "You know, I have some faith in you. Please, have this prayer book." I carry it in my purse, and it has not left my purse, in almost 5 years. It was this humongous, oh my God, I can't believe this man. He doesn't even know me. I don't know him. But it's that thing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter where you're at, no matter how low you're at, that reaching hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is always there. And I can't remember the guy's name. But hopefully I get back to Fishersville someday and find him out, because he made a huge difference in my life that day. And he says, "I think you need to have some more treatment." And my family at this point, imagine this, after 20-some-odd years, you know, with everything that was going on, they said, "We've had it. You know, you spent all your money. You know, this has gone on. This has gone on long enough. You're hurting us. It causes us pain. We don't want you back. We will not let you stay at our house. You're on your own." And with the counselor's help, and social workers, they said, I think you need more 7 more days over at New Hope. So I went over New Hope. Ah, there's a smiley face back there. A few of us been there. And spent some time there, which was the best thing in the world for me. A little bit more clearing of the mind, and you have to go to a meeting every night. And at my very first meeting back to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I figured, great, this is Stanton, Virginia. Nobody's going to know me. This is going to be okay. Yes, I was Sue back then in Winchester and rocking. But heck, if there wasn't somebody that knew me. There was this gentleman that in AA that goes back up and forth down to 81 and stops in New Hope for a meeting. And he looked, and I looked, and I'm like, oh, my God. And at this point, I mean, I look like Janis Joplin. I mean, I've got hair out to here. I mean, 215 pounds. And at this point, because of my infections that I've had, lack of taking care of myself, I had no teeth. Today I do have teeth, thank God, and I do have a receipt for them. Pay for it myself. But I looked hideous. Looked like something. Actually, there's a gentleman in my home group who's got like 25 years, and he remembers me back then. He says, it looks like something the cat coughed up. That's what you look like. Thanks, Ralph. That's exactly what I look like. But he, just that guy, the gentleman in the AA meeting that night, just come on, again, like that lady. And, you know, he's like, how are you? And I'm like, well, I'm here. And he just opened his arms warmly once again and welcomed me back. You know, it was just incredible that that gentleman was there that night. So upon the completion of that, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm homeless. You know, I faced the mission up there or what's going to be next. Call my old friends in Winchester. And it was a hard call to make because, again, you know, it was really strong recovery. And sure enough, they opened the arms warmly and said, if you can get up to Winchester, we can help you. We'll get you back into Edge Hill. There's not a woman's bed available. You can stay at the Salvation Army, and we can help you. They came and got me. A friend, you know, I asked my family, and they wouldn't take me. You know, they accepted one more call from me. No. But again, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the type of people you guys are. That giving. You came and got me. And I made up to Winchester, got into the day program, stayed at the Salvation Army. And for a girl that grew up in Northern Virginia, I was like, okay, this is where it's ended up to. This is the depth of your illness. And it's exactly where I needed to be. Precisely. That gift of desperation was there. That surrender point was there. And, oh my gosh, it was a good couple of weeks. But it was the hardest thing to accept, you know, what was going on. But again, you guys were there, kind of like holding my hand all the way. I actually had to sleep on the floor of the Salvation Army. It was very much like it is now, February, March, and I got sick. Ended up having to be hauled down to here to UVA. A lot of my docs are out of UVA, immunology docs. Winchester could not treat me. And actually it was my ex-boyfriend, the big old burly guy, that came and got me and took me. That was a hard thing too for him. You know, I've known him since I was 14, he was 16. But he was willing and willing, I can help you. But you've got to be willing to do this. Like, okay. Put in a UVA, smacked in there, IV antibiotics, isolation, had pneumonia, got better. And the social worker, again, you know, hospital social worker, what are we going to do with you? She put me in Salvation down there in Charlottesville on Ridge Street. And that's where things started to blossom, started going my way. God was really looking out for me. Within a day or so of being there, ended up going to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Charlottesville. Because I didn't know anybody down there. This guy was coming to the Salvation Army, picking up 3 guys who I did not know. And he didn't know me. You know, again, the Janis Joplin looking girl. And the guy said he's taking us to a meeting. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. picking you up too and taking you along. So there I was in a car, four guys. I have no clue who they were. They didn't know who I was. But we were going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was the As You Like at 10 a.m. Sunday morning meeting. And again, I have no clue what they said, but I knew I was in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And again, that seed that was planted by that woman, and once again by that counselor, was there. There's hope in these rooms. And at that meeting, I asked a woman to be my sponsor. And she only asked one question of me. She didn't care what I look like. She didn't care, you know, what my past was. She didn't care any of that. Sue, are you willing? Are you willing to do what it takes? And that was the first time somebody asked me that. And amazingly, I said yes. Because, again, I knew that not drinking, not changing was going to, I knew where that was. And for me, you know, I'm like a cat with 8.5 lives. I should be dead. And I knew if I go back out ever again, I will surely die. Or even worse than that, I will live in that perpetual hell of not dying and just living that alcoholic life. But this woman, my God bless her heart. I am so grateful for this woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. She came, picked me up at Salvation Army, took me to meetings, and was like, this is what we're going to do. Take me back to her house. We're going to open the big book. And what we're going to do is go from the very first page, which is totally blank. Because this is what you know. You know, I got sober in 1996. You may have came to Alcoholics in 92, but girl, I've got more sobriety than you. And I'm like, whoa. She cared for me that much. She loved me so much. She told me the truth. You know you got a good sponsor when they say the truth. Even though it may hurt, but it's the truth. And that's what this woman did. We went through the big book, word by word by word. We discussed what we were reading. And even though I had no teeth, I could barely speak, she made me read the damn thing, too. Yeah. But it helped so much. This woman, again, who didn't know who the heck I was, take me back to her house and to sit on the couch, offer me a cup of coffee, but just for me. You know, a woman that's in the shelter. That's the kind of love that's here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never felt it anywhere else. And we worked through the big book. I finally got out of the Salvation Army, got a little apartment of my own, and damn, found out the apartment was actually near where she lives. So couldn't make any excuses, like my car broke down, or this happened. You know, I just walked to her house to continually work. And one of the people that I met, actually, when I got sober, was a member of the Salvation Army AA meeting. And I became a home group member of that. And we united with another group and became a Vision for You. And here we were, a little bunk of spunky little one-year-olds in sobriety. And it was the most powerful experience I ever had. You get to learn about their traditions in a home group. I definitely threw the steps with my sponsor, but I had to learn how to play nice with others and how to work with others in unity in the fellowship. And, my God, my first year of sobriety was, a riot. I don't really remember so much of it right now. A lot of stuff happened. Again, Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a period in the summertime where I got another serious infection, had to be hospitalized and given IV antibiotics. And you guys brought a meeting to me. And she brought me speaker CDs. You know, she visited me each day. She brought a brand new sponsee with her. This is what we're going to do, you know. That was awesome. My home group was there. My first year of sobriety, you know, even though working through the steps, working through a lot of the stuff that I was working through was amazing. And I remember my third step. And this may be the tradition up here. A lot of women that I got sober with, we do an official third step. Here you are in a room with a group of women, and read a portion of how it works up to the, you know, third step prayer, and then we get down on our knees and actually do it. And the women that were there that day, you know, these women have 25 years sobriety, solid. You know, my sponsor had this woman over in the valley come over, and I'm like, again, for me? You would do this for me. And it was one of the most powerful experiences, and they share about that fourth step. Because that was stuff I was really scared of way back when it was, you know, back in the 90s. It was what an incredible experience. I just will never forget it because for the first time I was ready. I made that decision. I'm ready to get on with these steps. But I could not do it alone. We went through this fourth step, and then doing the fifth step with my sponsor. You know, I was scared to death doing that. You know, I've never shared with another person the exact features of my wrongs. Never. Never did that inventory. You know, like I had a feeling God knew. I certainly knew. But share with another person, you know, in the religion that I grew up with, I used to have to go to confessional. You know, and it was a little different. This time, actually, the woman shared with me some of the stuff she did. And I was like, wow, I'm not all that different. But finally, it was like a weight being lifted off my shoulders when I left her home that night and walked home. It was like, oh, wait, finally, there are no secrets anymore. I felt part of you guys. This is something that she did. And this is necessary. You know, I was not drinking, but I was changing. And it was thanks to her, thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to change. And then 6 and 7, making the decision, ready to turn the stuff over. 8, 9, whoa, that was a biggie. Because for so long, I was always blaming others, or it's so-and-so's fault. I have no part in this. You know, I don't need to make amends with anybody. But she brought me back to that fourth step. And, you know, a lot of the people I really owed amends to were like my family. And even though it took about a year or so before we would actually be able to speak to each other, you know, my family was the first people I made amends with. But my sister was my very first person. And I'm here to tell you, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life when I finally, you know, had my little sheet, you know, was going through, you know, this is the exact natures of my wrongs I've done to you. And she was amazed. She was like, my God, the very first time in my life, she was in tears, I was in tears, that she heard the truth coming out of my mouth, ever. And because I was for so long, I mean, saying, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, but this was different. And asking her, is there anything that I've missed? And is there anything I can do to make this up to you? There's some financial amends, you know, we can work on this. And she said, just keep doing what those people are telling you to do. Because I don't know what it is, but it's working for the first time in your life. That gift my family gave me back in 2005, that gift of desperation, was the best gift I've ever received in my entire life. Where somebody said, we've had it. We've had enough of this. It meant homelessness. It meant a lot of financial things. It meant this, it meant that. But it was a gift of desperation. The best gift I ever received from my family, ever. And jumping in after 8, 9, living in 10, 11, and 12. My God, what an experience. And to be able to give this stuff away. You know, part of our home group is very, very active in helping others. And, you know, just little things. Whether it's making coffee. You know, one of my first service positions was making coffee in my home group. And I shared it with a woman. you know. We looked at each other. When we got there at the home group going, do you know how to make coffee? No, do you? So we muddled through and, you know, made the coffee. It was it was very strong. And, to my knowledge, nobody died. But I'm still accused to this day of making very strong coffee. You know, our meeting, one meeting a night, you got to stay awake, right? You know. And then we got involved in other things in service. But I remember my sponsor, after we've gone up into the big book and gone, 12 steps, says, Sue, I think it's time for you to sponsor somebody. We go, what? Me? oh boy. So, a lot of meetings ask, are there anybody willing to sponsor people? Okay. And sure enough, women came up to me, and I'm like, oh, God, I have no clue what I'm doing. I don't know. The first person that asked me to be her sponsor was a lady from Britain. I mean, what I've got in common with her? She's got money. I don't. I don't know why she's asking me. She's never lived on the streets. But she saw something in me that she wanted, and I'm like, okay, in AA, whenever asked, you say yes unless there's a really good reason why you can't do it. And what an amazing experience working with that woman. She now lives up in New York, and it was just so beautiful going through the big book with her, just like my sponsor did. And I had to call my sponsor an awful lot. Oh, my God, I don't know what to do here. This is going on. What should I do? But the other thing that I looked towards was God. I had to pray for the right answer. I had to pray the knowledge of His will for me. What should I say here? What should I do? And, having reached into that spiritual toolkit that's described in the big book quite often when I started helping others. And hearing her fifth step, my God, what a privilege and an honor to hear another woman's fifth step. To see her face in the beginning shaking and then just kind of breathe afterwards. And it was funny, right after we did that fifth step, just as the big book outlines, take it down and, go through all the steps before, did you thoroughly do this? We actually went to a workshop, the Common Solution was being put on. I said, why don't you meet me afterwards? And she had a totally different, look on her face. You don't see it in yourself, but I saw it in that woman. And it was so beautiful. And it wasn't me doing it. It was a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just like when Bill and Bob started this program, one alcoholic helping another alcoholic. It was amazing. What an amazing experience. What this program has given me, meeting calamity with serenity. I have had some of the most tumultuous times in the last several years, but I've had the best times in the last several years in my sobriety ever. I've gone to Alaska. I went to a conference in Denali, Alaska with a group of AAs. It was wonderful. My God, what an experience. A group of young, we're going to go to Alaska. Yeah, right. When the person asked me to. This girl that was previously homeless, who was a group of alcoholics. And we were just trudging the road of happy destiny together, as we still do today. Been a part of a friend's wedding, last summer. What a beautiful experience, a recovery wedding. As I kind of alluded to, there's been some calamity. But again, I've had a reach in this virtual toolkit and depend upon you guys. And last summer, I had probably one of the most amazing experiences of my lifetime. I do service outside of my home group. I'm involved in the Jefferson District. I'm the Jefferson District Treasurer. How about that? Homeless girl, you can give them the checkbook. But again, I'm just but a trusted servant. And, I am responsible. And this whole service stuff that I've been involved in has taught me a lot of responsibility. You know, for the first time in my life, I am responsible. And I was also involved with the Virginia Area Convention last year as one of the co-chairs for hospitality. And I've had a lot of health problems in the last several years. That's required some medical attention down at UVA. And, boy, this one's going to be hard. Including some growths in me that causes like a secretion of a hormone, tumors that secrete this hormone, and UVA referred me to NIH, National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And last summer I was highly involved in this hospitality committee, still kind of sick, but by helping others it got me out of myself. It was just amazing experience. And when I found out I finally got accepted up there, I'm like, oh, crap, I'm leaving my home, my Charlottesville group. And I actually contacted my friend Lynn and to get in touch with some AA friends up there from Midtown. And these women, my God, what they did for me. Again, Alcoholics Anonymous is everywhere. They came and got me from the hospital. They came, took me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They came and were the fellowship. They were the sisters, just like my brothers and sisters back here. I will never forget that experience. I mean, going a week or so without a meeting is hard. I need the meetings. I need you guys. I need the fellowship. All the time. Not just part of the time. Because again, if I'm not drinking and if I'm not changing, I'm going to go back out. And a lot of the times the docs were like, well, you know you're in pain. We can offer you. I'm like, no. You know, no narcotics. And I'm honest with my doctors. Every one of my doctors knows I'm in recovery. That's how much I want to live today. I have to be honest with my doctors, even when facing really bad things. But the girls up there, you know, took me to meetings, introduced me to more women. And this one woman's meeting I will never forget. Afterwards in meetings, God, somebody's from out of town. You know, and newcomers and out of town. And they talked to me, and, you know, I found out actually one of the women is a nurse up at NIH. She gave me her cell phone. She said, I don't know if I can help you because I have less sobriety than you. I'm like, we can help each other. I don't care how much sobriety you have, and it don't matter how much sobriety I have. We can help each other. You're a lifesaver to me today. Two floors down from where I was, I can just hop on the elevator and visit her. Give her a call and just talk to another recovering alcoholic. It was just an amazing experience that I had. The reaching hands of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to be involved with the convention. Oh boy, that was a life-changing event. Growth. I've been involved in service, been to assemblies, and been active with the grapevine, you know, the staple free thing, but it was awesome. It was an awesome experience, especially going with the health problems that I was going through. And over the last several months, I've had, you know, the continual health problems, been back up to NIH. But again, you guys are there. My sponsor, God bless her heart. That woman is amazing. I meet with her regularly. Not just, well, and I don't give excuses. I don't give excuses. If I'm 5 minutes late, she's probably not going to say anything, but, you know, I still, out of respect to her, she's taking time out to meet with me. It is a two-way street. And it's just a wonderful experience to meet with that woman, to get that experience, strength, and hope from her. And again, she loves me so much, she'll tell me the truth. She's also been involved in service, and so I can ask a lot of questions. And when things go on crazy at district or with the convention, it's like, you know, finally somebody that, you know, I'm like, I can say the funniest things. And she's like, I understand, Sue. I understand. And, you know, here's a suggestion, what you can do. Or let's look at a concept. Or let's look at a tradition. You know, we have three legacies. I'll call them the 36 principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. the steps, the traditions, and the concepts. And, you know, I'm so grateful to have a sponsor that is familiar with them and actually works with them. And being involved, I have a service sponsor also. Oh, an incredible woman. And I get to see her in action all the time. She's with the VAC, and she's a committee chair. And she's always sharing with me right before she goes on stage. She taps my shoulder. She's walking up. Sue, one day you're going to be doing this. You know, look at petrification. But I just remember the day when I was sitting in the hospital room in the yellow gown. You know, a guy that come in the yellow gown and basically said the same thing. One day you're going to be sober and you're going to be able to maintain your sobriety. And again, I thought he was crazy, but he wasn't. And it's because of a loving God. It's because of a sponsor. It's because of a home group. It's because of being involved. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking action in the steps daily. I'm not here today. I want to thank everybody for being out here. Billy, for asking me to speak tonight. The Blue Ridge Speakers Group has, and you guys up here in Madison, have a special place in my heart. I want to thank you for letting me share tonight. Thank you.